Facebook telling spammers where you live, GeoHot in hot water, and Motorola blowing up your phone. All that and more on the Slongcast. Hello, and welcome to the Slongcast, episode 20 for Friday, January 21st, 2011. I am Kevin Slonka, and I have two guests with me this week. To my left, as usual, actually, to my left is not usual, but he is usually here, Ryan Lancey.
Yeah, my seat was stolen today.
And the seat was stolen by the man to my right, Mr. Tim Tender.
Hey, I didn't know it was your seat. You should have said something.
No, that's cool.
So, Tim, first time on the show. Why don't you tell everybody, you know, what you do?
Okay. Meteorologist, weekend guy for WJAC TV. It's the Johnstown NBC affiliate. Basically, I do weather throughout the weekends, and then I'm also in charge of creating our weather graphics, keeping up with the weather blog, things like that.
That's one thing I noticed. You do a lot of the a lot of the web-based work there.
Yeah, a lot of the web-based work, and then also what you don't see is a lot of the behind the scenes. I'm normally upgrading our weather computers, making different things to make them run a little bit better.
Very cool. And I also noticed that for those people who don't follow you on Twitter, you tweet a Ustream broadcast whenever you're driving back and forth between here and Pittsburgh.
Yeah, and it's not all the time, but yesterday we had some really bad weather here in Pennsylvania. And what happened was I was driving from Pittsburgh to Johnstown. Now, this drive, typically about 2 hours, hour 45, 2 hours. Well, I put this Ustream broadcast on, and I have a mount, and I put the Droid X right inside the mount, and it shoots out the window. And you can see the roads as I'm driving from Pittsburgh to Johnstown.
They were pretty bad yesterday.
They were pretty bad. The entire trip, though, took me 4 hours and 15 minutes.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's
ridiculous.
Horrible.
It was brutal. And then couple that with having to do morning show today, it's just, it's been a rough 24 hours. So if I start to ramble, just hit me or something.
I'll throw something. There's got to be something here I can throw.
We can use your mixer, right? It's big and heavy.
It's not that heavy.
Oh.
You would think it would be heavier, but, you know, it's kind of a cheaper mixer. There's nothing inside of it.
Oh, okay.
There's some rats, you know, and wheels.
Mice.
For the power, yeah.
Hey, I see plenty of things you can throw. I think I'll just watch.
Okay, I have some wireless mice I can throw. All right, so let's jump right in. We actually have a lot of stories this week. There was a lot of stuff happening. First one is one that I found interesting. You know, we had a bunch of stories a while ago about the RIAA and how they're always suing people. You know, they don't like when people pirate the music. But this is interesting because Universal and Sony are planning on something a little different to combat piracy. What they're planning on doing is releasing singles for purchase at the same time they hit the radio. Whereas normal, you always have to wait until, you know, you can buy the CD to purchase them. Their reason being that they think a lot of people pirate music from the radio. Are either of you guys doing this? Like, I don't want
I
that.
I used to.
Like 10 years ago, right?
10 years ago, you know, you'd get your cassette tape,
exactly.
Toss it in the tape deck, and there you go. But anymore, I see where they're coming from. And this makes a lot of sense to me because a new song comes out on the radio. Everybody wants this song, but it's not available. How else are you going to get it? But go to, you know, your LimeWires or whatever's left out there to download.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely agree with that. You know, getting it off of LimeWire or Napster or whatever else is out there now. I just don't, like, whenever I listen to music, I don't want it to be bad quality. Like, I don't want it from the radio.
Well, my guess is that somebody, you know, gets the, records it off the radio and then puts it up on, you know, whatever service
to share it.
You know, so while not everyone may be doing this, somebody with a, you know, good quality signal could make maybe a pretty good copy from the radio.
You can make a good copy, but all of a sudden you're going to have 96.1 Kiss FM coming at the beginning or the end, or you'll have DJs cut off. And, you know, you see that with songs on occasion, you know, a bad download, you'll have that.
Yeah, but how many people have you gone over to their house, you know, and they have this huge MP3 collection and, like, all their MP3s are like 96 kbps,
96.1.
Well, they might have it, but I mean, I guess what my point is that they're like very low bit rate and they sound terrible, and so I don't think people are really concerned with like bumpers on either end of their favorite song.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know.
That said, I think this is like a great move on the on their part. They should have done this 10 years ago. Had they made music available online 10 years ago, I think, you know, Napster never would have happened.
Yeah, I definitely agree. This is a good move. I just thought their reasoning was kind of funny because I, like, you know, like we said, I don't know anybody, unless it was 10 years ago, who's copying music from the radio. But hey,
I mean, it is possible. You know, I mean, I've done that for, you know, a local station back in Pittsburgh, B94, went off the air. They came back on the air. They went off the air. They came back on the air. You know, I was a big fan. So right. What I did when I knew they were coming back, I recorded their re-intro.
Nice.
And it was really cool. And I actually still have it on my laptop.
That's cool.
If I only had a couple extra cables, we could hook your laptop in and play it. All right. So this next article, I believe, Ryan, you submitted it.
Oh, yes. This one's... So Yahoo is planning to upgrade their network stack to support Internet Protocol version 6. I don't know if everyone's... I think we've talked a little bit IPv6 before.
We have, and how the 4 addresses are going away.
Yeah, so IPv4 is a 32-bit addressing system that leaves 4.3 billion addresses, I believe.
A big number.
It's a big number. But
not big enough.
Not big enough. Not big enough for even one person or one IP per person in the world. Not that everyone is on the internet right now, but a lot of other devices use it. So Yahoo plans to upgrade and support the new IPv6, but the problem is... that this may break, you know, people's connectivity to Yahoo. They expect it could shut out up to 1 million users. And the reason is that there are a lot of problems on the DNS side, or not, I'm sorry, not the DNS, the ISP side of the connection where the IPv6 connection is only partially implemented. And so a request goes out on IPv4 from the user's machine, and the data comes back on IPv6. But the data doesn't get through because the ISP hasn't set it up correctly.
Let me just throw this out there. Would it be so bad if people couldn't access Yahoo? I mean, come on.
I don't know. I don't know. I still like it.
I don't know the last time I was on it.
Yeah, I mean, I know a few people who use Yahoo Mail.
Yeah, yeah. Well, primarily.
But other than that...
Honestly, I use it for a couple of things. I mean, I still have my Yahoo Mail account, which forwards to my Gmail account. If I could find a way to, like, just not have to even do that, I would love it. But, you know, people still have my Yahoo address, and if I didn't keep it up, I wouldn't get mail.
Yeah.
The other thing is I use Yahoo Groups for a couple of things. There's some really, like, specific, like, groups out there for different types of electronics and stuff, and they're only on Yahoo, and Google has groups, but they haven't made it over to Google, and...
You should give Google's new CEO a call and say, hey, archive these groups. I want to use you instead of Yahoo.
Yeah.
And you'll get one new customer.
That's right.
That's worth the time.
You know, that seems like something Google would do, though. You know, they're all about being the big people with all the information. They probably would go out there and just archive everything they could.
Yeah. They might. I like the one thing I liked about this article is they termed this what they call IPv6 brokenness. And they have like ratings of the brokenness of the connection. I guess there's supposed to be some kind of IPv6 holiday coming up where a bunch of major websites are going to switch to IPv6 only to see how much traffic they get and what's broken and what's not. So
that sounds like the worst idea ever.
Why?
Like major websites?
Yeah, some big ones.
Like websites that make money.
I think they talked about it here in the article, which ones. It's a 3-page article, and I'm not going to finger through the whole thing to find it, but they did talk about it.
Wow, that is crazy. Oh, so, Yahoo has agreed to participate along with Facebook and Google.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so there.
That's going to be big.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I expect a lot.
I think it's a great idea. We need to get this problem solved now. I mean, like they're saying that we have probably 10 months or less until I think ICANN's released all the IP addresses now. There's none left. Maybe one block of .8 or /8.
Yeah, if all of them are gone, they're not used. They're just down right to the lower level distributor.
The regionals.
But until then,
but they're saying 10 months maybe.
They just need to go back and revoke IP addresses from people who don't use them.
Might help.
Such as a company that I used to work for who owns half of the internet and uses like 2 IP addresses. Yeah. Yeah, they need to be taken away. No names. All right, so moving on, we got a bunch of stories about Facebook. Facebook has really been doing a lot within the past week. This first one is just kind of a segue into it. It's from Framethink. It's an article about how Facebook ships code. Now, this is apparently inside information that I don't believe they say who it came from, just that the person didn't want to be named. But from what they saw while they were there, this really bothers me. Once you start working for Facebook and you're a software person, and you go through what do they call it?
Does Facebook make hardware?
Yeah.
I'm just kidding.
Whenever you go through the probation period, I put that in quotes, but you know, you're trusted by them now. You're not just a newbie. You get access to the Facebook code. Like, you can change Facebook. Every single software engineer in that company can change what we see on Facebook at any time.
Well, it's not quite like that. They do releases.
Yeah, but anybody has access to that.
Yeah,
everybody.
They could check it in and it could get released.
And
no one would know it. Yeah.
Yeah. Anybody can
possibly
do that. Like, really? Everybody?
Yeah. I think it would be fun to make random misspellings in different places.
I mean, there has to be a screening process. I'm sure there is. You know,
I would hope there is.
Well, it sounds like they go through some testing. You know, I think they would probably know if something completely failed.
Yeah, I don't think somebody would be able to take down anything. But I'm thinking more along the terms of being able to send personal data somewhere else. You know, that's something that doesn't break anything. They could do it behind the scenes and nobody would notice ever. You know?
Well, like the article says, though, they'll get a public shaming.
That is true.
I thought that was pretty interesting that they publicly shame. Was it publicly shame or publicly?
Well, either way, they get fired. Like, Facebook does say they have a strong stance on this, that if you get caught doing something with your power, there's no like, oh, I'm sorry, you're just out. So that is cool. But
they also have a public stoning in the middle of the square?
Yes.
Yeah. Oh, here it says, getting SVN blamed or publicly shamed or slipping projects will result in injury and getting fired. No. See, they retracted that, and they say people did not get called out for introducing bugs. They get called out if they weren't around to support a release, like if they made a change, that sort of thing.
They should get called out for everything.
Yeah, if you guys read this article out there, make sure you read all the corrections too, because there's a lot of things that like they didn't really cross them out, they just corrected them below.
Yeah. But keep going with Facebook. There was a big article that everybody was up in arms about. Facebook added to their apps, the third-party apps, you know, anything that you can add on your Facebook page, that those apps can now have access to your home address and your phone number.
What?
Wow.
Yeah, I tweeted about this because, you know, you know me, everything about me is public. Everything of me is on the internet. And as soon as this came out, I'm like, I don't feel comfortable anymore. I don't care that you guys have my home address and phone. I don't want advertisers having that. That is not cool. And then 3 days later, apparently, Facebook heard a lot of crap about it. They disabled that feature.
As they should have.
However, in that same article, they will be rolling it back out. They are just looking into new ways to tell people and make sure they're aware this is happening. So they fully intend on letting these third-party applications have access to phone numbers and home addresses.
I wonder if they're going to do the whole thing where, like, if you share it, it's shared. You can't say who gets it.
They might.
But the thing is, we have to look a little bit of precedent here. Let's take a look at like phone companies. So back in the day when phone companies were a main form of communication across the country, when you got a phone number, your number got published in a book, your phone number at least.
That's true.
And it did have your address as well. So I don't think Facebook's like way off the mark on this one. But, you know, because anybody can grab a phone book and get your address and phone number.
I think it's just the scale. You know,
it is. It's searchable. And,
right. Yeah. Back in the day, the only people who could get my phone number were the people who would drive to Johnstown to get a Johnstown phone book.
Right.
Nowadays, it's China. Like, really?
Yeah, but how do you know that phone company wasn't selling those lists to...
We don't.
See, I think it's probably legal now.
But. I think the other thing about it is the secrecy of all of it. You know, I mean, Facebook releases this update, pushes this update out there, but there's no box at the top of my Facebook page saying, hey, by the way, we're letting out all of this information about you. Tell me. If you tell me, I'm fine with it.
Yeah, the only time they did that was when they totally revamped the privacy features, and then we all got that box. Hey, we have a new privacy setting. Click here to see how to use it. But other than that, for minor updates, they don't tell you.
And then you see everybody just in a tizzy about these updates and these changes, and you just see it as random bits and pieces as their Facebook status.
Right. Yeah, it's...
Just tell us the full story.
Yeah. Well, if they tell us the full story, they won't make money because they can't sell our stuff to advertisers.
Also true.
Yeah. But next story, still on Facebook. Ryan, I believe you submitted this one.
Yeah, this is from the venerable John C. Dvorak. Yeah, Mr. If you ever guys watch, there's a podcast. Well, I guess it's a video podcast, right?
Twit?
Well, no, he's on Twit, yeah, but he has his own called Cranky Geeks, right?
He did have his own.
Oh, that's not
around
anymore. It
got canned a couple months ago.
Oh, that's too bad.
I know.
It was pretty boring sometimes.
Well, it was his version of Silicon Spin, which used to be on ZDTV and Tech TV, where he has on, you know, pundits and talks to them.
Yeah, if you guys have ever seen Charlie Rose on PBS, it's a little bit like that, really bland, but usually good tech info. Anyway, he wrote an article called Why I Don't Use Facebook. I suggest you read this article. It's very, I think it has some very good insight into, you know, what Facebook is. He makes a lot of comparisons to the early years of AOL, and I've never heard anyone make that comparison before, that Facebook is just the logical extension of AOL, that had AOL been allowed to, you know, continue their path and had made some slightly better decisions about what they had created, that you would end up with AOL. Because Facebook is starting to turn into a little mini internet. Like, recently a friend of mine started up a web page, and I'm like, I thought to myself, hey, let's make a page on Facebook. You know, so all the people that we, you know, can't contact through other means can see this, but we're friends with them on Facebook.
Right. Nobody's thinking now, hey, let's make our own website. It's now, hey, do you have a fan page on Facebook?
Yes, yeah. Exactly. So, and that's kind of what AOL was. So I don't know. What do you guys think? I mean, it makes some pretty crazy assertions there.
He does. I hated AOL. I still hate AOL. I just had somebody today tell me that their personal email address was at AOL.com, and I wanted to say,
wow.
Really?
Still?
Still?
Yeah.
Like, what are you doing? But yeah, I mean, I think you or John brought up a good point that Facebook is a mini internet.
It is. It's like a little mini internet.
I mean, you used to have people say, you know, how do I get to the internet if I don't have my AOL icon? Or I don't have my AOL CD. I don't have the internet. I don't have the CD. And now it's like that if they don't have Facebook. Like, what are they going to do? And I don't know, Tim, you probably see this a lot with people advertising on TV now, that they're not putting websites down. They're putting Facebook pages.
Right. They're putting their Facebook pages. They're also putting their Twitter pages. And, you know, we have one for our station. You know,
right.
WJAC has a news page for Facebook, and we have a weather page for Facebook. We still have our websites.
Right.
But, you know, I mean, even on our main websites, we're linking to our Facebook page. But I think the difference for us is we're actually using them in terms of an interactivity kind of thing. We're getting information that back and forth with the viewer.
Right. Yeah, I mean, I don't know that you guys could take your whole website and just put all that data onto a Facebook page. Like, you do too much on your website, too many articles and such.
Video, everything
else.
Yeah,
that Facebook couldn't handle all of that.
Yeah. It's an interesting comparison, though, I think he makes. And I also think, I mean, some of it, I kind of agree with it. He's, you know, he says at the end, there's no reason for anyone with any chops online to be remotely involved with Facebook, because it's really like the simpler system. It's not, you know, it's meant for the masses. It's kind of like web TV is to the internet, like 10 years ago.
That.
Yeah. It's, I mean, that's kind of what it is.
Did either of you have web TV?
No.
I actually used it in a hotel once because I was traveling, and it was back before I had a laptop and I needed to get on the email, and I used web TV.
What did that cost you? Like $10 for a minute?
No, it was like, I think for the whole night, it was like maybe $10 for the whole night.
Oh, wow. That's not bad. It's not bad at all.
Yeah, it was fine.
So our next article is still in the social networking realm. I don't know how much anybody cares anymore, but Tim, do you use MySpace?
I used it for about maybe a year, maybe.
And how many years ago was that?
Probably about 4.
So a long time ago.
It's been a while. It's been a while.
Ryan, MySpace?
I haven't deleted my account, but I can't remember the last time I logged in.
Yeah.
Usually I'll check it just in case somebody who I know is only on there maybe sent me a message.
Last time I saw an article about MySpace having some sort of big security vulnerability, what it was a year or two ago, that's when I deleted my account. But it doesn't look too good for MySpace. CNN Money says that they just cut 47% of its staff, 500 employees. I mean, I just want to say, duh.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I think MySpace has lost a lot of opportunities to brand itself as the sort of the place for music. Bands still seem to prefer MySpace, at least especially local bands, local and regional bands. They have better tools for putting your music up on the site.
I was just going to say, if Facebook had a tool where you could upload music and have like a multi-track player,
right,
there would be no need for MySpace.
But, you know, I don't think Facebook needs to be this everything to everyone type of service. You know, like maybe they want to focus on people and what people are interested in. And the bands, you know, maybe they want to focus on, you know, providing their product.
Well, look at it from the band's point of view. Don't you want to have your product where the people are?
Well, right, but you can always link to your profile. You know, maybe they should try some strategic partnership and say, hey, this is what we have that you don't and what we can offer. The other thing, it was, you know, I'm surprised, well, maybe not surprised, but like Apple started this whole Ping thing.
That's gone nowhere.
Yeah, they have this, you know, social music networking thing built into iTunes now called Ping. And rumor has it they approached Facebook about this and they really wanted Facebook to, you know, merge in with that. But I think MySpace would be a perfect place to go.
That's actually a really good idea.
Yeah.
I think Facebook should reach out to MySpace. Although maybe they see MySpace as a company that's going to drown and they don't want to sink money into it.
Yeah, they could just be waiting for their demise and then, you know, then they'll bring out their own tools. But, yeah.
Didn't they already, and I'm trying to look this up as we're talking, I thought that there was some sort of connection between MySpace and Facebook, some sort of partnership that they launched. And this comes from the press room. MySpace introduces mashup with Facebook. Now, I obviously don't have time to read the entire article, but this is coming from myspace.com/pressroom, and this comes from, it looks like, November of 2010.
Wow. Hmm.
So I don't know exactly what this is about, but so maybe they're already on it.
That is interesting.
It says, Mashup with Facebook is an opt-in feature that is quick and easy to set up. Users can visit myspace.com and click on Mashup with Facebook button to begin. Just a few simple clicks. Basic MySpace profile is created. Users can immediately begin building their personal profile. I don't know exactly what it is or what it does, but...
Yeah, so maybe it could either pull down information from Facebook or it could link you to a Facebook page from a MySpace page. But still, that's interesting. I didn't hear about that. Like, how did this slip past everybody?
See, I thought a couple of months ago I'd heard something about some sort of partnership.
Yeah,
and,
here.
You know, it felt like that was like the final straw for MySpace, right. Giving in to Facebook.
Right.
Wikipedia mentions it. The company fully integrated with Facebook Connect, calling it Mashup with Facebook.
Oh, interesting. So yeah. Now you can probably see on some people's pages under their likes that they liked a MySpace page.
Yeah.
If Facebook Connect is on there. Okay, so that's not so bad then. I guess they really didn't sell anything to Facebook. They just kind of used their API.
Right.
Hmm. Interesting. I still think they should go away.
Yeah. I'm with you.
So, Ryan, I believe this next one is yours.
So everybody's been waiting for it.
Everybody?
Everybody. Everybody who doesn't have a Mac. Boo. Hiss. No, I'm just kidding. I like Macs somewhat. No. So Microsoft is nearing a release. The rumors are of Service Pack 1 for Windows 7 and Server 2008 R2. This is you know, pretty interesting. It'll be nice for new installs Windows 7. You won't have to go through the whole rigmarole of downloading 100 different updates,
right?
Which is nice. And typically, Microsoft puts a feature in there so you can slipstream your Windows 7 installation with the Service Pack 1, so then you can make a disk and install it, you know, if you rebuild your machine.
At least decently smart people can do that.
Yeah, it's not too hard.
Do they have a tool that they make now that does that?
It used to be you just download the full install, and then you did a slash like C, and it would slipstream it.
Yeah, exactly. You open up a command prompt and type, you know, the Service Pack name slash this, yeah. Location equals this.
Yeah, it was easy.
I know it was easy, but for 90% of people who have never seen a command prompt before.
Well, most people aren't going to reinstall their, you know.
That's very true.
But I'm just saying, if you do this, if you are someone who, I don't know, has to build machines frequently somewhere, you know, it'll be nice for techs. They can make an install disk with
Q1.
What's that? Oh, yeah, quarter one.
So it should be out soon.
Yeah, there are some rumors that it's already shipped to OEMs. Those are false. According to Paul Thrott, he said that hasn't happened yet. I checked his blog a couple days ago about that. But look for it soon.
So, Tim, I noticed you're running Windows 7 on your machine. Are you the type of person who will get a service pack as soon as it comes out, or do you like to wait a while?
I like things as they happen. You know, I'm already running like Firefox for the beta. You know.
Nice.
You know, so I'm one of those guys who likes things, you know, quick, fast, and in a hurry. And you know, I'll get it.
We won't tell the women of the world.
No. I knew that was a joke coming somewhere there. That was way too easy. Way too easy.
That's the only one I'm going to get in because I can't think that fast.
So this service pack, you know, I think with XP, they had a service pack that had just some updates, like some cooler features,
They had SP1A, I believe, which was a weird service pack.
Oh, yeah, for XP way back in the day.
Is there anything in this that you saw for, you know, people who don't really care about the security updates?
Actually, there's very few things with Windows 7. There's more. I think there's actually more substance for Windows Server 2008 R2. Paul Thrott's Win Super Site or Super Site for Windows, he details the changes in the bigger items in the service pack for Windows 7. Nothing to me looked like it was a big leap forward. But I just know whenever I rebuild a machine, I hate that first Windows update where it's got to do like 40 to 50 updates.
Well, here's what I hate about the first Windows update. The first one isn't 40 to 50 updates because the first one is only like 3 or 4 updates because it has to go download the newest version of the MSI installer and the newest version of whatever. And you think, oh, I'm done, 4 updates. Hmm. And then you reboot and it's like, bam, 40 updates.
Yeah. No, I know what you mean.
I just did that with my parents' computer. I gave them Windows 7 and I thought, oh, this is great. Okay, Windows 7 hasn't been out for that long. Maybe there's only 4 updates. I was wrong.
No.
Very wrong.
There were 4 updates before it was even released.
Yeah. That's very true.
Here's a quick list of the things that you'll see from Windows 7. There's an updated version of remote desktop services, better support for some third-party devices that use, Federation devices. Is that like Starship?
Are they talking like Active Directory Federated Services?
Oh, maybe. That might be what it is. I guess some improved HDMI audio performance. I guess a lot of devices had some sketchy HDMI performance. Minor XPS document fixes and hotfixes and other bugs. So nothing huge.
Not much.
Nothing.
But for me, like I say, it's all about not having to download 100 updates.
Yeah, definitely, because they will definitely roll in the previous 100 updates into that. So have any of you ever lived in Australia?
No.
Nobody?
Last I checked.
Well, that's good, because if you did, you would be on a dating site, whether you wanted it or not. There is an online dating company called Gotham Dating Partners. They're from Australia. And what they plan to do is go from 6.5 million members to 340 million by scraping public records on the internet. So any information they can find out about anybody who lives in Australia, they will scrape your name, address, phone number, whatever they can find, and make you a profile on their dating site. Whether you want it or not, you got a profile.
How do they know you're single?
That's the thing.
You don't.
There will be so many marriages broken up by...
Why are you on this dating site?
Right. I didn't do it, really.
I thought you loved me.
This seems like something Facebook would do.
Yeah, it's pretty crazy. It reminds me of, have you guys heard of Spoke, like Spoke.com?
No.
Is it, I've heard of like Spokio.
No, it's Spoke, Spoke, like a spoke in a wheel.
No, I never heard of it.
It's very similar to LinkedIn, I guess. It's like, but it's more like employer centric than I think it is. Like, you know, LinkedIn seems to be more employee centric,
right?
Where this is more employer centric. Anyway, I somehow got into their database. I've never signed up for their service, but I guess they have a history of doing this,
right,
where they pull public records and put you in, and then it's like, is this you? Are you the Ryan Lancey that lives at such and such address, or there are, you know, you lived in, you know, wherever, New Mexico, from such a year, you know? And then you go in, and then like, to get yourself out of the database, you have to sign up. And even then, I don't think you can.
That's the exact problem with this Gotham Dating. If you don't want your stuff on their site, you have to finish the sign-up process to join you to your profile that you didn't make in the first place, and then you can delete your account and delete your profile.
Yeah, it's crap.
This is...
Yeah.
I mean, I would never join a dating site that did... I would never join any site that did this. Like, that seems like spam email to me. If you get an email that says, hey, we made this for you, you know, go check it out.
Yeah. Oh, dude, it's like when you get the unsubscribe link and you click it and it's like... Oh, make your account so you can unsubscribe. It's like, crap. No, I don't. No. I never signed up in the first place.
So have either of you used chat roulette?
No.
Really?
No.
I've seen some stuff on chat roulette.
Well, I think everybody has.
Yeah, you know, Piano Guy.
Piano Guy is awesome.
Piano Guy is awesome.
But
I have no idea what you're talking about. Honestly.
Really? Like, no. You never heard of chat roulette?
I have not heard of it. Okay. I, you know what? I skipped over this article.
Well, you know what? Like, I think there might be a lot of people who haven't heard of chat roulette, because the only reason I heard of it is because, you know, they talk about it on Twit and some of the other tech shows that I watch.
Oh, wait. Is this... Oh, go ahead.
Yeah. This is exactly what you're thinking of.
So I have heard of it. I just didn't know the name.
So this is a speed video chatting site. So the way a chat roulette always worked is you... Go to chat roulette. There's no accounts or anything. You have to have a webcam connected. And immediately you are thrown into the queue with everybody else who's on the site. And some random person pops up on their webcam and connects you with you. And then you can type or speak, because voice, you know, the full webcam, voice and video. Well, the thing with chat roulette is that every other person was a penis. I almost made Tim spit out his Dr.
Terrible
Pepper.
Terrible timing for that comment.
And I am not joking. Like, if either of you were to open up chat roulette right now, I guarantee you within three, you know, next clicks, you would have some naked dude sitting in front of his camera.
Let's try it.
Please do. I just want to see your face.
Oh, dear God. No, I'm just kidding.
But so that was a problem, obviously. Although some people might have liked it. But chat roulette decided to start banning IP addresses. They wrote an algorithm to detect the shape of a penis.
Wow.
And when they detect that, they banned IP addresses, so you couldn't get back on. But now they've changed their tune a little bit. Nudity is their new business plan. So what they are doing now is they are getting referral dollars from adult dating sites. And instead of banning an IP address when they detect a naked guy, they're just sending them to an adult dating site. And every time they get a link back, you know, from chat roulette gets money.
Ah.
Hey, that's smart.
Ah, I know. I'm so disappointed that neither of you have been on there, because no. we could have shared that. Ugh.
The disgust.
The disgust, yeah.
You got to watch the sound you make during our podcast. Oh,
that's true.
Yeah, this is...
We're not video yet.
Yeah, it's audio only.
Okay, so enough of chat roulette. I don't want any trouble.
Smart plan.
Okay, we've gone blue. So, Google reCAPTCHA. Everyone has probably seen, when they go to sign up for an account, you have to type those stupid squiggly letters. Nobody can ever understand them. Well, Google's version of that is called reCAPTCHA, which was done by CMU people, and that's Carnegie Mellon. And the whole point of reCAPTCHA was, in addition to adding security, it was also translating books. So they would actually scan in pages from books that the computer couldn't translate with OCR software, and you would be translating the book as you deciphered the letters. Well,
really, really ingenious, actually. I never knew that until I read this article.
Yeah.
I was like, wow.
It's awesome. Well, it's been cracked. So now machines can break through reCAPTCHA and sign up for accounts and all kinds of crap. I say, how bad is this? If machines can do this and can go through reCAPTCHAs at like 100 per second, we're just translating that made books.
Yeah. You well, know? It is going to help them there, but what I wonder about is, how does somebody else have software that is beating Google's algorithms at the OCR?
Yeah, or CMU. Like,
yeah,
either of the two.
Really, anyone, honestly. I mean, like, how do these hackers have the money to put into it? Well, I guess this guy's saying it's hacked. It's not out there and in the wild yet.
That's true. But still, no, I agree. I didn't think of that.
Google, by the way, defends that this... I read the article. They said that, you know, they say he's using an older version of reCAPTCHA and that those things were fixed later on. But then he contends that he was able to crack even more of them.
Yeah, he said, after they said that, oh, we put out a newer version of reCAPTCHA, so your stuff isn't going to work, and the dude came back, he's like, no, it actually works better now, thanks.
Hmm. Wow.
It's just... It's ridiculous that it means signing up for accounts are going to be that much harder now, because we thought reCAPTCHA was it. You know, that was the way to protect against spammers, and now it's not anymore.
I liked, they talked about Microsoft's method of, you know, making sure that the person using the computer is a human, which, by the way, the CAPTCHA name is based on that, what it does. I don't know if everyone's familiar, but it's the completely automated process, or completely automated public Turing test to tell computers and humans apart. It's a really cool acronym.
Yeah, but I didn't realize, you know, like a year ago that that actually meant something.
Yeah.
Nah.
But Microsoft's method of this, they're calling it something else, like DIP or something. Anyway, oh, HIP. HIP, yeah. Sorry. Human
DIP sounds better.
Yeah, human interactive proof. Much simpler acronym. They use pictures from a database of cats and dogs, and they ask the humans to tell them, is this a cat or is this a dog? It's something that a computer is very poor at right now.
Well, find this hacker. I mean,
yeah.
If he can do OCR better than Google, I'm sure he can detect dogs and cats.
Well, if you think about it, though, the complexities of dogs and cats, like, there are some dogs that look like cats.
Cats that look like dogs.
Right. Well, yeah. You know what I mean, though? There's features like pointy. Some dogs have pointy ears like cats.
Right.
You know, some dogs have like a long or shorter snout, you know. So, right. Like, it might be really tough. The things you'd have to key on would be very, very specific for a computer.
Yeah, that's very true.
And that would be easier for us. Creating accounts, we can tell a cat.
Right, exactly.
Yeah, I would rather do one click on an image than try to figure out letters that I miss half the time.
Exactly. That's why I really like this method from Microsoft. I say we get rid of reCAPTCHA and go to.
I say we get rid of CAPTCHAs as we know them completely, whether it's Google's reCAPTCHA or any other version. Just no more CAPTCHAs. Let's go with Microsoft's version.
Yeah, like that's.
Whoa! Hit. Wait! Somebody get that in writing.
Oh, I just said go with Microsoft.
Kevin just said go with Microsoft's version.
Yeah.
Okay, Slongcast is over. See you guys later. Though, I hate the CAPTCHA so much. This morning, I was trying to get tickets to the Taylor Swift concert, and which I didn't, by the way, because I got so mad because I kept missing the CAPTCHA. Every time, it's like, nope, that's wrong. It's like, nope, that's wrong.
Yeah, oh, I know.
Was that the Ticketmaster site? Or?
Yeah, Ticketmaster site.
Normally, they're pretty good because you can miss one word. Normally, yeah. And you're still okay.
Well, okay. That made me remember something. So if whenever you put in the answer to the CAPTCHA and it tells you, no, you did it wrong, doesn't that mean they already have the answer? So if they already have the answer, are we really translating these books for them? They already know what it says. It's already been translated.
That's a good question.
Wow. What? Yeah, like what's going on?
Well, they said that Google supports a one-off system, meaning that if you're one character off, it'll accept it. So maybe the character that, like, they're hoping that the character that's really hard to decipher, the human deciphers, and then they use enough answers about that.
So you think that one of the characters I was missing was one that I shouldn't have missed?
Right, exactly.
So or I'm just an idiot then.
It could be. I don't know. You know what else is interesting? The reCAPTCHA system, is it the one that, on Google's website, on their own website, they do a lot of character recognition to validate your account. But it never looks like it's text from a book, where, like, the one from Ticketmaster does look like it's text from a
book.
That's
true. The ones on Ticketmaster definitely look scanned, like they're scanned letters.
Yeah.
But, yeah, Google's don't.
They always look like just auto-generated or something.
That's weird. So
I'd like to read a little more into this and how exactly it works.
Yeah, so maybe Google doesn't even trust their own system.
Maybe not.
You can read up on it, google.com/reCAPTCHA.
Yeah, see, the ones they picture there, I'm looking at Tim's computer, they look like books, and they look like the ones on Ticketmaster.
Yeah. It almost looks like the book, but it's just like the page is crumpled, or there's a wrinkle in the page, because there are lines there.
Oh, so something to try and trick a computer who's looking at it. You know, we can tell it's just a wrinkle, but the computer's like, oh, that's not a letter.
Maybe.
I wonder if that's there.
You know, my guess is that they have a pretty good guess of what it is. They just want it confirmed, you know.
That could be.
And then they take a statistical analysis of the answers and say, what's the most common answer, you know, and then, you know, go run with it.
That's true. They do have a lot of PhD math people working for Google, so there's probably more things going behind the scenes than I could ever imagine.
I'm guessing it works.
Yeah.
Based on Google stock price, I'm guessing it works.
That's true.
I would hope so.
They need to split. Okay, next story, Ryan, I believe is yours.
So this is kind of, I don't know, I guess sad. Google has decided to yank H.264 support out of their Chrome browser. Now, I guess everybody's pretty familiar with HTML5 by now, and Chrome is an HTML5 compliant browser, as is Safari and IE9 beta, which is supposed to release soon. And I guess Firefox 4 is pretty good at it too.
I've never used Firefox 4. Is it?
You know, I just started using it. Like, okay, literally. So
you mean you haven't gone
ago.
To the ACID site and, like, run the ACID 3 test?
Oh, ACID 3.
No.
Oh, darn it. Well, anyway, the HTML5 supports a canvas tag, and I think that's the tag you use to embed video, right? Or is it the...
Yes, it's the canvas.
Yeah. So they've had built-in support for H.264, and they've decided, they released a post on the Google Chrome blog, and they've said, you know, it's not truly an open standard. We want to support open standards, so we're going to supplant this with our WebM codec, which is also known as VP8, I believe.
Yes.
I don't know. What do you think about this?
I have to ask why. I mean, H.264 is kind of the codec right now. Everybody, everything uses it. Oh, no. Somebody forgot to silence their phone.
Throw them out.
Yeah, I don't... I'm just wondering now, you know, Tim, do you watch online videos on any site at all?
Yeah, a little bit, sometimes.
So what would you do if you started using Chrome and you went to a website and it just didn't work because the codec was no longer there?
I'd be done.
Yeah, you would stop using the browser.
Yeah.
I mean, this is my fear with Google Chrome. If they do this and they don't find some easier way of people to get that back... Like, aren't people just going to switch? Aren't they worried about people stop using their product?
Well, I still don't think this will, you know, they'll still support plugins. So technically there could be a plugin that would play the H.264 video, I think.
It's just that would make sense, yeah.
All they're removing, I believe, and correct me if I'm wrong, is the native support for H.264.
Right, that's all it seems like, right?
And there's a lot of controversy surrounding the whole, like, video in the browser idea, because, you know, I guess there's two camps. One camp's like, well, look at pictures. Every modern browser supports decoding pictures in the browser.
Every picture.
So they don't pass this on to the operating system. The browser does it in its own code. however, video is not this way in some instances. In others, it is. Like, I guess in the instance of Flash, okay, any Flash video is going to be passed into the Flash plugin, and then the Flash plugin is going to handle it, the display and decode through itself and the operating system. I'm not exactly sure how their stack works, but there's definitely other video types that are handled by the operating system.
Right.
And here's the key point about that. If the operating system handles it, if there's hardware in the machine dedicated to that purpose of decoding video, then the operating system can take advantage of that. Right now, the integration between browsers and operating systems is not such that they can offload the decoding of the video to the hardware. So there's a big discussion of whether we should even have video decoding in the browser anyway.
Yeah, I'm a part of the camp of they can do it for pictures, they should do it for video. Like, I mean, how mad would everybody on the internet be if whenever you went to a website, you had to go download the JPEG plugin, and then you had to download the GIF plugin, and then you had to download the PNG plugin?
Right. Well, I mean, it's definitely a pain, but it's something that, you know, you do once. It's a you do it once every time you upgrade your browser or well, really, like, big upgrades, typically. It's like...
Right, like your whole computer.
Yeah, you know, or something. You know, so it's like a one-time shot. I think you'd hate it to do it for every image type, but there are image types out there that aren't supported. Like, JPEG 2000 is not supported in browsers. And JPEG 2000 is all the Library of Congress uses. They also use another format called Mr. Sid. That's the only two formats they put all of their archival images in.
Mr. Sid?
Yeah, MRSID. I think people say Mr. Sid.
No, I've just never heard of that.
It's a type that...
Is it a vector image? Or?
No. What's the... Wavelet. It uses wavelets to store the images.
Interesting.
So, but I don't like it. I think they should have left it in there, the support. But then again, I'm not even sure browsers should have native support for video. I think, you know, if you spent $500 on this awesome video card that supports the latest hardware decoding of some video codec,
you should use it.
You should use it somehow. Now, maybe this just means that macOS and Windows and Linux need to get off their duffs and support a video API into the browser, like, directly. And I could be speaking out of ignorance here. Maybe that already somewhat exists and people just don't use it.
Or maybe they're not doing it for some huge glaring reason that we don't know about.
Right.
Yeah. I don't know. So I guess we're all in agreement that we think it's not a good idea, at least at this point.
No, I don't.
This is awesome. It's like the first time everybody's agreed on something.
Well, you know, one final point on this too. There's an article somewhere about this. I think Slashdot had a link to it. Whatever they linked to, they had a comparison of the openness of the different codecs out there, like Flash,
right,
H.264, and WebM, and there was one other one. I can't remember the last one. You know, some are developed openly, meaning that there's people that collaborate openly to do it. You typically have to be involved in some sort of working group, which the membership of the working group is conditional based on, like, what you do and
how many open source projects you've committed to in the past.
That, or like, you might have to be a big company that's involved in this sort of thing. Some publish the spec for free. You can use the spec. It's just the specific implementations that are proprietary. Both codecs have different things. Like Google has made the code available, published a spec, but the thing was developed completely in the closet for WebM. So it's open in one sense and closed in the other.
Right.
H.264 was developed in the open. They published the spec, but the implementations are proprietary. So it's not all apples to apples. You have to kind of read up on them to really make a good decision.
Yeah, way too. I think we could have a whole episode just on that.
Yeah, sorry.
Which we're not going to. All right, so our next article comes from the Treehugger website. Literally, treehugger.com. And they talk about a new type of computer hard drive, which could be made from bacteria, specifically E. coli. So this seems really cool that they have found a way to store data on or inside of the DNA of living bacteria. Now, my only question, I mean, I hope you guys know more about bacteria than I do, because I know nothing, but what if they die?
That was my thought. I was just wondering the same thing.
Yeah, I mean, unless you're going to keep your computer inside of a fridge for some bacteria, or, you know, always at 200 degrees so they can multiply.
Yeah.
Like, I mean,
well, you're assuming that by retrieving the data from the bacteria, they need to be alive. If the data is stored in their DNA somehow, they may be able to, you know, you can take DNA samples of dead skin cells, right?
So my computer is going to have syringes inside of it.
I don't know. I don't know how it's going to work.
Yeah, I don't know either.
It's really interesting. The thing that might be, if you think about it, like, if you think of DNA as data, we can get DNA from hundreds of thousands of years ago. What hard disk is going to last that long?
Right.
That's true.
You know, even if it's not complete, even if you lose a little bit of the data, it's better than losing it all.
So I might have to stop using CrashPlan to back up my data and start using E. coli.
Yes, exactly.
I wonder if anybody will complain if I start placing large orders of E. coli over the internet.
You might have some trouble with that.
Yeah, I might have some trouble with the FDA, which happens to be our next article. The FDA is considering regulating wireless networks in hospitals. Now, whenever I first read this article, I thought, really? They don't do this yet? People could die. So for the longest time, any networkable equipment that kept people alive, or, you know, anything like that inside of a hospital, was done on a separate network, not connected to the internet. Nobody had access to it. There was no wireless. If there was, it was proprietary. Nobody could get on it. Well, now, within the past 10 years or so, with technology becoming very cheap and IT administrators not wanting to administer multiple types of technology, hospitals are starting to use off-the-shelf technology for everything. And now, this is leaving things like heart monitors and, you know, breathing machines on networks that people can hack into and shut off. So what do you guys think about this? You know, either part of the story, why haven't they done this before, or that they're doing it now?
Well, it sounds like it could be part of a plot to a TV show or a movie now.
Oh, it could be on House.
It actually could be. I mean, you know, that's a lot of vulnerability.
Yeah.
You know, you have say the president goes into a hospital, you know, he's hooked up to a heart monitor. There you go. Simple enough. There's your plot.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, or even like unintentional consequences. Like someone doesn't hack in on purpose. They just like use some wireless network and, you know, kill the bandwidth and the machine shuts off, person dies, and they're charged with involuntary manslaughter.
I was just going to say that. Somebody drives up outside the hospital. They hop on a Wi-Fi access point because people don't realize Wi-Fi goes hundreds of feet.
Yeah.
Like you could just drive up outside a hospital and
hundreds
get on.
Hundreds of feet?
Hundreds. Hundreds. Literally.
Hundreds. Wow.
But yeah, I mean, if you do that and you're downloading over BitTorrent or something, you're spiking their bandwidth. Okay, I'm not trying to like make BitTorrent look bad here. But let's say you're transferring large amounts of data that kills their bandwidth. And
yeah, you know, you're like a lowly medical student. You're at the hospital. It's the first time. You start downloading stuff from the Mayo Clinic, and all of a sudden your patients die.
Yeah, seriously. I mean, what if a doctor goes to send a command to a machine to, you know, up something or lower something, and that packet doesn't get there because somebody hacked into the network and killed the bandwidth? Like, I was more surprised at this article that they haven't been doing this already. And they're still not doing it. They're just considering regulating these networks. Like, really? Do it.
I don't know why they just don't use... I mean, I know in the IT world, when you want hard and fast, secure network connections, use fiber. It's like, why aren't these connected with fiber? Why do they need wireless? I guess maybe they're mobile beds or something, but...
It's probably because the IT people are retards.
That could be.
And they just want things that are easy that they know.
I don't want to run a cable up that wall.
Exactly. Yeah. No cables are better. Speaking of killing people, though, this next article, I don't know if you guys had heard about this, but it's really freaking amazing. So a couple months ago, there was a big hullabaloo about this Stuxnet virus. You know, all the major virus companies like, oh, we found this new virus. We're blocking it now. Don't worry about it. But nothing really happened with it. Stuxnet never hurt a single person's computer. So everybody was like, oh, what's going on? Well, just recently, which has actually been on the news in the past couple days, this Stuxnet virus was, for all intents and purposes, nobody is claiming this, it was a U.S., you know, secret spy virus intended to shut down Iran's nuclear plants. The U.S. isn't claiming it. Israel isn't claiming it. But it was, I can guarantee you, it was an NSA or CIA written virus, and that's what it was for. And it was really cool because, as you guys can imagine, those things aren't connected to the internet. You know, things that are critical, people don't connect them to the internet. So how do you get a virus there? The person who wrote this virus wrote it in such a way that it was so polymorphic that it could change itself. Anytime it detected a certain type of software, it would change itself. It would load onto USB drives. If it detected something, it would change itself again, hop onto another USB drive, and eventually it made its way, you know, some idiot in Iran plugged in his USB drive from his personal computer to a computer that was connected to the nuclear centrifuges, and that's how it got in, and it hit itself, so it didn't kill anything. It just slowly changed the values so that the centrifuges spun too much and eventually rumbled apart.
Yeah.
Wow.
Amazing.
And the other interesting thing they mentioned was that it recorded the normal operations and played normal operations back to the
right,
monitoring.
Put it on the screen.
Right, so that no one would be even suspicious of this.
Yeah, I mean, this makes me... This is Jennifer Garner in Alias. You know, this type of virus.
Yeah.
Except in virus form, not a person form. This is a spy at work. And I think this is amazing.
It's amazing, but it's scary.
Oh, it's very scary.
I mean, hey, we can do it. So who else is out there doing it? And what do we have coming into the U.S.?
Exactly. What types of things do we have? Because, you know, these are like Siemens nuclear centrifuge controllers. We run those too.
Yeah.
You know, what's to say Russia didn't already implant that stuff on our network and now we're just waiting for stuff to blow up?
Well, there's a couple things I think that were key. The type of centrifuges they were using were like a Gen 1 centrifuge from like a long time ago.
Yeah, it was old hardware.
Right. So I think those specific centrifuges were vulnerable to this attack. Another interesting thing is a couple months ago, I think maybe during the summer, Dateline had a story about something similar to this, about how some of our like power plants are vulnerable to this, not necessarily nuclear, but lots of power plants have control mechanisms. And there's like secondary cooling equipment and safety equipment that they were able to infiltrate through a network. They didn't really say they used a virus. They you know, somebody hacked into the network and was able to, like, basically do a similar thing. Tell the monitor of the, like, the remote monitoring device that the gauge on the, you know, pressure gauge was fine, but yet overrun, open some valve that made the pressure go up or whatever, or drop, right. And then it blew up.
Yeah, that's the thing with all, I mean, everybody's equipment, nuclear stuff, power grids, they're all so old, they were never meant to be on the internet, let alone a network.
Yeah.
So there are no security things in place.
Yeah, I really don't understand why these things have to be on the internet. Like I understand why they're on networks. I don't understand why those networks have to be attached to the internet.
Well, they shouldn't be. And in the case of Iran, they weren't.
Right.
So that was really cool that somebody was able to get a virus inside of a network that's not on the internet. For me, somebody who loves watching spy shows like Alias and like Chuck, this is amazing. So we have a couple of stories about some, you know, audiovisual television stuff. The first one is more along the net neutrality line. Also, the FCC approved a joint venture between Comcast and NBC. Basically, two of the companies who are against net neutrality, because they want to be able to control their data and who sees it and how fast it goes. And I don't know what you guys think, or I don't know, Tim, if you've been following up on net neutrality stuff, but what do you think about this, that the FCC, a company who is pushing for net neutrality, is now allowing two companies against net neutrality to get together?
See, I don't know enough about it to really have a great opinion one way or the other at this point.
What do you think... Coming from the TV realm, what do you think this would affect in terms of local television? A net neutrality thing, would you guys have trouble getting your signals out to the people who want to watch it or putting out stuff on the internet? Do you see this affecting anything that you guys do?
At this point, I don't. I got to say that, you know, if they're approving this, there has to be some sort of backup in place saying, hey, you can't take these local stations off of, say, Atlantic Broadband or, you know, whatever cable company is out there.
Right. And that was one of the things I was worried about because, you know, Atlantic Broadband is, for all intents and purposes, Comcast. And, you know, if they're one of the companies that are doing this, they could just say, oh, yeah, we're slowing down WJAC. Like, we don't like you. We would rather have a Pittsburgh station. It's like,
there was a video there you put in the show notes about net neutrality that I watched.
Yeah, I'm actually going to play that next week during the show because we have some really good net neutrality articles set up for next week.
Right. I mean, I think I guess the point is, you know, that this venture, this joint venture between these two giant media corporations, it's just, I mean, I really think the FCC needs to monitor this, like, you know, and see how it goes and see if they abuse their power. I'm not totally opposed to the merger right now. I'm just interested to see if the FCC, if something does happen, will there be ramifications?
Right. Yeah. I do like a couple things they're doing, you know, requiring Comcast to offer $10 broadband to low income houses. They're requiring Comcast to offer internet versions of their content, like SNL and other shows. So the deal does have some good effects. But I still think that, yeah, they have to watch them. Putting these two companies together and letting them join forces in the long run might not be a good thing.
Well, here's the thing. I don't think anything's going to happen in the beginning. It's going to take them probably a year, 2 years, maybe 3 years down the road before they start saying, let's see how far we can push this envelope.
I can definitely see that. You know, think of Facebook. When Facebook first came out for the first 5 or so years, oh, Facebook's cool. All my friends are there. And now we're starting to see Facebook steal our data. You know, this could very well be the same thing with net neutrality. People just, you know, hang back for a couple of years and then all of a sudden kill us.
But on a TV standpoint, it actually might be good. NBC, you know, it has some good shows. NBC has some good shows, but the problem is... Exactly. But the problem is a lot of people aren't seeing them. So maybe by joining up with Comcast, and Comcast owns some other TV stations, right?
Oh, yeah.
They own, what, G4 versus?
Yeah.
QVC.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
So, you know, I mean, you join up with those guys, plus you have USA and Bravo and, you know, everything else. It's a great opportunity for NBC itself to really promote itself and hopefully get out of number 3/4 status.
That's very true. So now people who don't watch much TV will be able to watch the TV shows on the internet. Because most of the people now who don't watch TV are younger people who are in front of their computer 24/7.
Right.
So now they have access to NBC shows, bump up those ratings. That's good. You're always thinking.
I try.
So this next article, Tim, came from you.
Yeah, and I just found this interesting. Basically, we all know Pac-Man. We've all played
Pac-Man. Love
Pac-Man. Pac-Man may be getting its own reality TV show.
Say what?
Yeah. The article is actually, it was from, I believe, Mashable.
Yes.
And basically, what they're trying to do is make a game, I guess, similar to what Wipeout is. And, you know, you're going to have contestants running around, and I'm assuming they're going to be grabbing dots or...
Oh, so like, people get to be in a maze?
That's what I took from the article.
Oh, this is awesome.
And chased by ghosts.
Yeah, chased by ghosts. And what I'm thinking is, you know, each pellet, if you will, that you pick up is going to be worth some sort of amount of money. And then if the ghost catches you, maybe they take your money. I may be totally reading into that the wrong way, but...
No, that's definitely the idea that I got from it, and I think that is... I want to go on the show.
How about a reality version of Mario World? Super Mario
Ooh.
World? That would be awesome. You run and you like hit blocks and stuff.
That would be awesome, but that would take a lot of money for somebody to make a world that you have to run through.
Yeah, that's true.
How big would that have to be for a real person?
It could be like a virtual thing.
It could be virtual.
I wouldn't take it virtual. I mean, in the days of having now, we have Wipeout and we have, you know, these stunt shows.
Right.
You know, no one wants to see somebody running through a virtual world.
Yeah, nobody wants to see somebody on a green screen.
No, no. You want to see people actually out there trying to jump up on top of blocks.
And, getting hurt.
Yeah. Of course they'd be foam.
Yeah, if that was me, I would definitely get hurt. So that, I'm signing up. As soon as either of you guys see when this is coming out, let me know. I will be the first one to sign up for that show.
Yeah, I mean, it looks pretty cool. you know, obviously, it's ways away from being produced. But, like, the article says, if ABC was willing to pick up I Survived the Japanese Game Show...
Yeah, really.
Why the heck not do a Pac-Man game? I mean, think of all the people who know and love Pac-Man.
And if nothing else, it can go on Fox. Oh!
Burn.
They'd pick it up.
They are. I do like a lot of shows on Fox now. So, Ryan?
Yeah, so this is pretty cool. Going along with the TV theme, everybody likes Jeopardy, right?
Oh, yeah.
Ken Jennings.
Yeah, Ken Jennings, the famous guy who won like $75 million or something.
Longest streak ever.
I don't know how much money it was. It was a lot of money. Jeopardy is going to put Ken Jennings and I guess the other champions they've had up against a computer. In a couple, I guess it's a couple weeks from now or maybe a month or so.
It's pretty soon.
Yeah, it's coming up soon. Well, they had a test run of it recently, and they had some video online. And the computer they're putting up against is IBM's Watson.
So this is very similar to, what was it, Big Blue or whatever, well, did they the had, chess tournament?
Yeah, they had Deep Blue and Deep Blue Thought. They have had a lot of these massively parallel computing systems that go up against humans in different challenges. And I think everybody remembers the famous chess match between, I think it was Deep Blue and, I can't remember the chess master's
name. If you say the name, I'll remember.
Yeah.
Kasparov keeps coming
Kasparov.
To my mind.
Gary Kasparov, yes. And I think in the first round, Gary beat him. And then they came back a couple years later with some updated, machine
code
and code and whatever. And the second time it put him away.
Yeah. I remember that was a big deal that a person beat the computer.
Well, I mean, it was a big deal that he beat it because they thought it was so good. But then it was an even bigger deal that it beat him. The meaning that they were able to, you know, assess the problems and turn it around. But this IBM Watson uses, I guess their Power 4 processors. It's massively parallel and has it's very good at I guess the thing that it has to do that is a big step up is voice recognition. You know, they have to be able to see or hear the announcer's voice and understand what they said and then search a huge database of all of the possible answers and, you know, come up with it.
So is that how it's doing it? It's listening to Alex talk. It's not OCRing the screen.
No, they stated in the video that I watched, there was an interview with one of their senior engineers, that it was actually, you know, doing natural language processing. That's the word I was trying to think of. Yeah.
That seems a lot harder than if they were to just screenshot the screen. And
you're probably right, but I think they wanted it to play as a contestant would. I mean, most...
That's fair.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, I guess contestants can read too, but most people, I think, probably are faster with, you know, if you hear what they're saying, you know, it just seems to come to you faster. I don't know. I'm not sure maybe it does both. Maybe it does read it as well.
I don't know.
But the part of it is like when you're asked a question, you know, we as humans like kind of like almost can predict what the question's going to be. Like once you hear the first couple words, you know, or, you know, you start to categorize things like, oh, they said president, so I'm going to think all the presidents, you know. These are things that are new for computers in terms of language.
Yeah, a lot of people just don't realize how computers are completely unlike the human brain. Like, you know, if you've studied how computers actually work and how processors work, you realize that, you know, it's yes or no questions. You know, that's all a computer can do, or off.
Pretty much.
And to make it act like a brain?
Yeah.
That's ridiculous.
Yeah, it's really impressive. I suggest you watch the video if it's really, really cool to watch. And then there's also a follow-up on, I think Engadget had a follow-up with one of the engineers. And it totally wiped the floor. I mean, it went through a couple categories and, like, just crushed them. And then Ken came back a little bit, but in the end, it won this test round.
By the way, okay, I was going to say, February 14th through the 16th.
That's what it is.
It's going to be on. Yeah.
Oh, cool.
Need to mark my calendar because I will definitely forget. That is way too far away. So our next story and our last one in the television realm is something that is pretty big among really, really geeky people. And if you're not a really, really geeky person, you probably don't even know that this happened. But ever since the PlayStation 3 came out, you would always had an option within their normal menu to install another operating system. So this allowed people to install Linux on their PS3, and by doing that, they could then play homebrew games. So allowing the normal person to write their own video games and play it on their PS3. Well, recently Sony took that out. You can no longer install another operating system. And a very famous hacker, GeoHot, George Hotz, I believe is his name, he was actually the first person to jailbreak the iPhone. He now jailbroke the PS3 so that you can add this feature back in and install another operating system and play homebrew games again. Well, unlike with the iPhone, where eventually the DMCA got changed, so jailbreaking phones is completely legal now, it's not the case with video game consoles because Sony is suing the crap out of him.
Well, it's not that it's not legal, but they're bringing suit anyways, right?
Well, it's not that it's illegal.
Right. They're bringing a civil suit, I guess.
They're bringing a lot of suits.
Yeah. They're bringing guys in suits with briefcases, and they're going to take him down.
Well, I mean, even the grounds that they're suing on, like, there are multiple. It's not just a single civil suit. There are multiple things they're going after this guy. Have you heard about this at all, Tim?
I heard a little bit, but here's my thing. You bought the system. It should be yours.
Exactly.
Do what you want with it.
Exactly. You're not renting it. It doesn't go back to Sony when you're done playing it.
Yeah. You know, in that same vein, I was just watching a thing on iFixit.com. There's a video. Did I send that to you?
No.
I didn't. I guess Apple's been sending, as they've been repairing iPhone 4s, they've been putting in pentalobular screws. It's a five-sided screw.
Pentalobular.
I like saying it, actually. Yeah, they put in five-sided screws in the bottom of the case. They're basically like a tamper-proof screw. If anyone's ever worked on some different types of electronic devices, you know, they typically will use like a three-sided Phillips instead of, you know, typically
something
four.
That you don't have.
Right, or Torx with a little pin in the middle so a normal Torx can't fit in. They're just called security screws, and they do require security bits. Well, this is a new one that I think Apple probably owns the patents to or something. Pentalobular. The point I'm getting at is that the host on iFixit said, you know, when I buy my iPhone, it's my iPhone. If I want to put a different color case on it, if I want to make the case all different colors instead of black, I should be allowed to do that. You know?
Yeah, I mean, and there was another article, you know, talking about this whole, excuse me, this whole Sony suit, and that it's a very slippery slope here because Sony is trying to get into, you know, legislation that they own everything they sell you even after you buy it.
Yeah.
You know, that's what's going to happen if Sony wins this lawsuit.
And that's a problem.
And that is a huge problem. But on G4's website, actually not on the website, on Attack of the Show, Kevin Pereira interviewed Geohot. So I have a couple things here that Geohot said. I want you to hear his answer to some of these questions.
See what comes of it. What exactly did you do? I mean, we explained that you posted this sort of hack, this firmware update to the PS3. What exactly did you allow users to do to their PS3s?
Right now, still legally, you can go to my website, geohot.com, and download my jailbreak for your PS3. And what it lets you do is install homebrew applications. And these are applications that have been developed by anyone. You can go develop your own applications,
sure,
too, or go download some and put them on your jailbroken PS3.
So people can run unsigned code for the first time on their systems. Well, not for the first time, but at least using your hack they can. But the issue then becomes using that hack to potentially, they could also play a pirated game, right? And that's where Sony takes issue.
Actually, no. The way piracy was previously done doesn't work in my jailbreak. And I made a specific effort while I was working on this to try to enable homebrew without enabling things I do not support, like piracy.
So then what do you think the issue is? What exactly are you being sued for here?
Making Sony mad.
Ah, well, that'll do it.
Doesn't that say it all?
Yeah.
I mean, really, Sony really doesn't have any grounds to stand on, but somebody made Sony mad.
I mean, he said he even took, precautions so that you couldn't play pirated games.
Right. What more do you want?
Right.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, what about this side of the argument, though? Like, so let's say I buy an air conditioner, and the air conditioner has a warranty for 4 or 5 years, and I decide that I want to mod the air conditioner. Do you think the company should still support the warranty after you've modded it?
Absolutely not.
So would you be comfortable with Sony saying, okay, fine, you can install things on our machine, but we will not let you connect to the Sony Live Network or whatever it's called?
I don't know about that.
No.
I can see them not fixing your machine if you break it.
Agreed.
But connecting to the Sony network?
Well, it's their property. What if they've decided that what you've done may introduce errors into their system? I mean, do they have a right to that property in any way?
That's tough.
Yeah, I mean, like, here's another example. Maybe to make it a little more comparable, the air conditioner might be a bad example. Let's say you connect to a city sewer system, and, everyone does pretty much, their house does.
If I build my own toilet.
Right. If you build your own toilet, or you mod a toilet, or you mod something that connects to the sewer system, and it dumps something down the sewer that shouldn't be dumped, or it puts too much pressure on the system, or whatever. I mean, doesn't the sewer system have a right to say, no, you can't connect if you're not going to follow our rules?
The sewer system, I think, should check to see if you're causing problems. If you're causing problems, then say, hey, get out of our sewer.
And I can see another thing, like, what if you make it too much, a high pressure toilet, and you break the sewer lines? What's the sewer company going to do? They're going to make you pay to fix it.
Right.
So applying that to this, what if you break the PlayStation Network?
Right.
Are you on the hook to pay billions of dollars to fix it?
You might. And that's the thing. Like, in some ways, Sony may be just protecting the users from themselves. Now, that's not to say that they should, I don't think they should be able to completely restrict the system, but I think if they offer a service, they don't have to let you connect to it if you're not connecting to it via their terms. It's,
Yeah, and I don't think that a lot of homebrew games are going to connect to the PlayStation Network.
No.
Probably not, and that's why I think they should be allowed in the sense of just, modding it, but I think if they want to block you from connecting to their network or any of the updates for the system until you put the original firmware back on.
Yeah, and for the most part, or at least the way it used to work, is that it was a dual boot. So it didn't wipe Sony's original PlayStation firmware.
Right.
You could always boot back in and play your normal games and whatever. I don't know. I'm more worried about the long term if this becomes a law that, Sony can tell you what to do. That's totally not cool. So we have a couple mobile phone stories, or mobile device stories, because they're not all phones. And Ryan, you got the first one.
Yeah, this is pretty interesting. There's an article on Ars Technica about why you should always encrypt your cell phone. There's a case of a someone, I think it was in California, somebody was apprehended by the police, and in their possession was a cell phone. The police searched the cell phone for evidence, which they're allowed to do. Once you're arrested, your personal effects are allowed to be searched. That's been upheld by precedent via the Supreme Court. Whether or not you agree with that is
I'm strongly against precedent, but
go ahead. Well, I mean, it's what's been established in our court system, at least. So the police searched the cell phone and they found something illegal on the cell phone. I'm not exactly sure if the article details that.
Yeah, I don't remember seeing that.
That part's really not too important. Basically, though, this person is the Supreme Court of California ruled that the police do have the right to search it. And if they find other things on your phone, that they can prosecute you for those things too. So that said, there is a caveat in the personal effects search. Say you had a trunk and the trunk's locked. They don't have the right to break the lock.
And there was also something I read about people with laptops and having them encrypted. You don't have to give up your password.
Exactly, because that under the Fifth Amendment, you would be incriminating yourself. So basically, there's a pretty strong precedent or belief that if your phone's encrypted, that if they did get the password out of you, it would be I take that back. If you give out the password, that you'd still be admissible if you freely give it up. But if it was coerced out of you, it might not be. But that's a good reason to put a password on your phone. Not to say that they couldn't unencrypt it. I think they are allowed to unencrypt it or try. I can't remember the exact.
Yeah, I'm not sure.
But anyway.
It's still a good thing.
It's a still good idea because if you have illegal things on your phone, I guess.
Yeah, I was going to say. I mean, you got to have something illegal on your phone, really.
It's kind of the whole socialist thing. If you're not doing anything bad, you got nothing to worry about.
Well, right, but there's another article. I didn't post it to the show, but I had put it on my Facebook account a couple days ago about the complexity of the laws today and the fact that there's tens of thousands of federal laws now that don't have a mens rea requirement, and a mens rea requirement is that the person have basically ill intent to commit the crime. So you may be doing something illegal, not even know it, and be prosecuted for it, because these laws don't have this mens rea requirement.
Right.
So, I'm not saying that people are doing things illegal, and I'm not trying to say, if you're doing illegal, but you could have done something inadvertently and you didn't even know it was illegal.
Well, that's like arresting me because I have Nmap installed on my computer. A port scanning tool that some people think is illegal to scan networks. Well, just because I have it, you can't arrest me for that.
Right.
But I guess you can if the law doesn't specify.
Is it actually illegal to scan networks?
Yeah, because it's like, breaking into people's networks and knocking on ports and...
Oh, really?
Yeah,
didn't know that.
You can't do that. So, Tim, do you encrypt or at least put a password on your phones?
No. Yeah. I don't. I'm very trusting. I'm a very trusting guy. So I have my phone and anyone could just jump right on and see what I have on there. I really don't have anything to hide. And that's the thing.
That's kind of how I feel. I mean, I don't have a password on my phone either, mostly because it's a pain.
Yeah.
Like if somebody sends me a text message, I don't want to have to enter in a password to read my text message.
Right.
That's horrible. Do you have a password on your BlackBerry?
Yeah, I do. I don't always, I don't have it encrypted though. So I just use the password. And the only reason I had the password is just, you just never know. Like if you're planning a party and trying to surprise somebody and somebody reads it or, you never know.
Yeah, that is true. It's just for me, I get so annoyed after the first two times of putting my password in.
Well, I typically only do it if, maybe if there would be something I need.
If you are doing something illegal.
Yes, exactly. That's one. So no, I don't encrypt it.
Now you've heard it, folks. If you ever see Ryan's phone with a password on it, you know he's up to something. I hope certain people are not listening. So our next article actually has been superseded by a newer article that came out in the past day or two, but we'll talk about that. Some people have been reporting with their Windows Phone 7 phones, they named that so poorly, that they were going over their data plan, their data allowance. They were getting notices from AT&T that you're going to hit your 2 gig limit, and the dude's like, I haven't been doing anything. So he went back and checked on AT&T's site where you can see your data usage, and every day, 2 to 5 megabytes per hour, he wasn't using his phone. It's just randomly sending out stuff, like 50 megs a day or whatever it was, and he got up above the 2 gigabyte limit, and this was happening on a lot of people's Windows Phone 7s. So Microsoft is like, they shrugged it off. Oh, yeah, we'll look into it. Well, a day or so ago, they said, Yeah, it's some third-party service that is doing this. We'll check into it and get back to you. So, Tim, what do you think about this, that a phone is doing this and that... go ahead.
See, here's my thing. It's a third-party service. Where are they getting this?
Well, it comes with the phone, apparently. I don't think it's something that anybody has downloaded.
Well, that's one of those things that they need to tell you up front. Hey, your phone's going to send out 2 to 5 megabytes a day. You got to be, you know, per hour or whatever it was.
Yeah, it was 2 to 5 megabytes an hour.
Yeah, I don't even know if the warnings really matter too much, though, because I've seen a lot of applications when you use them, they say, you know, notice this... this application uses data, and if you were on a roaming network, it, you know, may incur charges from your carrier.
Yeah, and it wasn't the thing about this is
in
that
my
he wasn't
best
using
radio
it.
Voice. Sorry. Yeah.
Coming up on CNN. Yeah, but I mean, the dude wasn't even using his phone, and it's sending out data in the background with nothing open. He's not using it, and what bothers me is that Microsoft would let code into their phone that does this.
Well, is it sending the data out, or is it just getting data? I mean, like,
no, it's sending, literally sending data.
Right, but I mean, in terms of sending or receiving, like, you know, my Twitter application could malfunction and decide to, like, check my Twitter account every single minute and maybe push me over the limit on my usage, right?
I guess that is possible.
You know, it doesn't have to be sending. I mean, I think it's very weird that it's sending, but it could have easily been grabbing data, like downloading a web page or something.
Yeah, you're right. Very easily could have. But in this case, it was sending. And it was code that came with the phone, written by a third party. That's what bothers me.
Yeah, it's weird.
Yeah, I mean, I could understand if this was an app that you downloaded, and, you know, the apps aren't always the greatest.
Right, apps
break. We
all
know this. Yeah. So, you know, that would be okay, and, you know, maybe you call AT&T or you call whoever your company is and say, hey, you know, my phone's been acting up. Can you help me? And they probably would.
Right.
But, I mean, this being a Microsoft Phone 7 or Windows Phone 7, whatever the heck they call it, I mean, that being in the actual phone itself from the get-go, I see that as a problem.
Yeah, and this is, you know, I'm going to push iPhone again. This is why I like Apple's iOS software, because Apple approves everything and makes sure this crap doesn't happen.
Well, yeah, but I mean, this could easily have been just a... we're saying this comes on the Windows Phone 7 device from the factory this way.
Apparently.
It's third party code, but Microsoft's probably just saying, oh, we subcontracted this part of the OS to a third party because they're very good at this type of stuff.
I don't know if it's that kind of third party or if it's like the Facebook integration that Facebook wrote to give to Microsoft, if it's that kind of third party.
Yeah, I'm not sure. But yeah. I mean, this could have just as easily been something in the iPhone iOS software that, like, you know, went to Apple's website and kept checking in with their network or something, you know, and it could easily happen in the OS code too.
Yeah.
So I mean, it's definitely a quality control problem, but who knows?
Yeah. It's one more reason why I'm not going to get a Windows 7 phone, you know, that they let stuff like this happen. I mean, I guess until Apple lets stuff like that happen on the iPhone, then I'll want to switch from them. But Tim, what do you use as your phone?
I have the Droid.
Which one?
I have two of them right now.
Really?
I have a Droid X, and I have the original Droid.
The original, okay.
Yeah, both of them are good. Obviously, they have bugs. Everything has bugs.
Very true.
I know you probably say your iPhone doesn't, but...
No, there are some bugs.
But no, I mean, they have bugs. You got to get over them. You know, some things are not that bad. Other things, you know, you're like, what the heck are they doing?
Right. And which one do you like better of the two?
See, it's tough. It's a tough gauge. The X has a huge screen, and I love that. Games are great. It's just...
How big is that compared to this, my iPhone? Is it
the entire iPhone fits...
On the screen.
Pretty much on the screen.
Nice.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's... I don't know. I like the screen. I like the setup. It's using Motorola Blur.
I've heard bad things about that. Is that okay?
So it has Moto Blur on it.
It has, yeah.
I didn't know that the X had that.
Yeah, it has Moto Blur. The original Droid didn't. And I really like the original Droid setup. You know, I actually had to go in and block a phone call on my original, or a phone number on my original Droid, and I had no problem. There was actually an option in there that said, block this number every time it comes in. But with the Moto Blur on this Droid X, it didn't let me do that.
Huh.
You know, I had to go find a workaround, which was just an app downloaded from the App Store. But overall, it both phones have hits and misses. Really do.
So does the original Droid just use the base Google Android skin? Like Motorola didn't put a new skin on it?
No, Motorola didn't skin the original Droid.
Okay.
I ended up doing that, but I downloaded, you know, a ROM and made it look different.
Ah.
But
so you got rid of the bloatware that came on it?
Yeah, and you know, the phone works great. Obviously it has hiccups. The phone's well over a year old and I have all kinds of stuff on the phone. So, you know, it's taken its toll on the phone itself, but
yeah, we'll talk more about those specific phones in a couple articles we have coming up. I want to get your opinion on, but sticking back with the Windows phones, here is an article from PC Pro that really bothers Microsoft. Intel is planning Windows 8 phones. Now, this isn't Windows Phone 8 like a mobile edition. This is Intel saying, we're making a processor, like a dual-core processor, for small enough devices such as phones, and so powerful that we can run the full version of Windows 8 on a phone.
Hmm.
And Intel is planning on doing this. And Microsoft is like, whoa, we make a mobile OS for a reason. Don't do this to us. So, Ryan, what do you think about this?
Well, it's interesting that a couple days ago, Microsoft announced that they're going to start, you know, making Windows 7, or well, at least Windows 8, available for ARM. That probably pissed Intel off. So I think that this may just be like a stab back, honestly. I don't know that for sure, but it's a poor one because, I mean, I love Windows 7. I think it's the best version of Windows ever released. I'd say it's probably one of the best operating systems ever released, consumer operating systems. And, you know, I just don't think I'm going to want to use it on a 4-inch screen. A tablet, maybe. Maybe a tablet.
Yeah, that's the thing the article pointed out, that, you know, these are not touch-enabled OSs, Windows 7 and Windows 8. Like
Windows 7 is touch-enabled.
Well, it's not as much as you would need for a small phone.
No, you're right there. It doesn't have quite the design, UI design that you need for a touch, but it does support touch. Like there's a lot of HP, a lot of people wonder why Microsoft redesigned a lot, you know, their interface the way it is now, especially
with bigger buttons and stuff.
Bigger buttons and the ribbon. Like even the ribbon doesn't really have bigger buttons. It's just it's situated in a way that it's easier to touch. And, you know, I think for people that have, there's a few of these touchscreen PCs, they haven't been super popular, but I think once people start to use them, they may become more popular.
Right, such like a convertible laptop where you can flip the screen and set it down and it's like a tablet.
Right, or even just, you know, there's still like a lot of people have computers, but there's still a lot of people that don't have computers and that, you know, if they might just want to have a little internet terminal in their kitchen or something to check in the morning, to check the news and the weather, and having it touch enabled makes a lot more sense than having some weird remote with special buttons or a keyboard. You know, maybe the keyboard's there for text entry, but,
right.
You know. So, anyways, getting back on the story, I just think that putting Windows on a device smaller than a screen of, like, I'd say 7 inches is just really silly.
Yeah, what do you think about that, Tim?
See, I think it could actually work, but you and I, we all know that if it comes out on a phone, it's going to be skinned. The company that puts it out is going to put some sort of skin over top of it, so you're not going to see the Windows operating system unless you want to.
Right.
And I would be okay with, you know, having my phone that has a skin on the front of it saying, hey, you know, text, email, whatever. But if I want to do something really fancy, then I could say, let's do Windows. Hit the button and then hit the start menu, do whatever you want to do. I'd be okay with that as long as it were a phone with a decent screen size. Like, I think the Droid X could pass. iPhone size, probably, maybe.
It's getting small.
Yeah.
On the small side.
But, I mean, it could work.
So you're okay with a full Windows OS as long as, you know, there might be a skin on it that makes it easier to use.
Yeah, and you see that all the time with, like, HP laptops anyways. I mean, they're coming out with skins on top of them, TouchWiz or whatever
it's
called.
Yeah, and Dell does the same thing. They put this Mac-like dock on their laptops with their buttons and stuff. And yeah, so that is a good... I never thought of that about a skin. I always just thought of, you know, trying to touch a 2-pixel start menu on my phone.
Yeah, I mean, I think it could work.
I think the problem that they're going to run into is, you know, I mean, I think they can skin it, but Windows 7, maybe Windows 8 will be, but Windows 7 isn't really designed to be skinned in the sense that they, you can replace the whole UI layer. You know, you can change the color, shape, probably some graphics that are built into the menus might be able to be switched out, like, you know, like with themes, the way themes,
right.
I think they're slightly different now in Windows 7, but that said, because it's not, you pretty much have to run a whole app on top of it, the way that dock works and the way that TouchWiz, like you
right.
were talking about, it's going to slow the thing down. I mean, I don't know how the you know, and yeah, you could run Windows apps, but they're not going to be touch enabled. That's the thing. The apps have to be touch enabled.
That is true. Apps won't be skinned.
You know, they need to make an API so that you could make the apps conform in such a way that they're usable.
Yeah, so maybe we just go back to what you originally said. This is just people taking stabs at one another and they're not really going to do it.
Yeah. I mean, the way it's phrased, he says, we have the ability to put our lowest power Intel processors running Windows 8, you know, into phones. Like, you have the ability. Of course you have the ability, but would you do it?
Right, yeah. So this next article is kind of a downer also. T-Mobile says, download at home after slashing the data cap. So basically, people would use T-Mobile, and you know, there are those people who use a lot of data, but now T-Mobile cut their cap. What is it? 500 megabytes a month now. So that's lower than pretty much every other company. And their reasoning that their PR people gave is, if you want to watch movies or anything, download them at home. You shouldn't be using your phone for that stuff. Tim, you're shaking your head.
Yeah, I already have problems with that. I mean, you know, phones can do so much anymore, and they advertise them as being able to do these things.
Right, that's how they sell.
That's how they sell them. So if you're going to advertise them as being capable of doing this and that and the other thing, you know, the company that offers that phone needs to live up to their end of the deal.
I totally agree. And this isn't just phones, because there are netbooks and tablets that have 3G chips in them that connect to T-Mobile and other carriers. And those are, quote unquote, normal computers that you should be able to watch videos on. So is T-Mobile going to kill them too?
Yeah, it's pretty interesting. It says in the article that, you know, after they hit the cap, that they're only going to prevent them from downloading large files or videos via their handsets. I don't think it's total shut off of network.
That is true. They are being nice. You can still browse the internet. You just won't have access to download large files or to sites that stream.
Right.
You know, anything that's a bandwidth hog. So they're not cutting you off, but still.
But essentially, if you want to use your phone for those things that you want to use your phone for,
you can't.
Yeah.
Yeah, this is ridiculous. And, you know, we talked a long time ago about the whole mobile phone industry being one big oligopoly, and that once one company does it, the other ones are going to do the exact same thing. And this is what I'm worried about, that if T-Mobile actually, well, they do actually do this. If T-Mobile does this and doesn't rescind what they just did, that other companies are going to say, hey, they can cut their cap. Let's do the same thing. And with LTE now, are they going to have to? I mean, Ryan, have you heard anything on T-Mobile's LTE implementation? Are they even going to do one?
With T-Mobile?
Yeah.
No, I think, well, maybe down the road, but right now they plan to release another version of HSPDA.
Right, so they're like AT&T, they're doing HSPA Plus first.
Yeah, right. And yeah. But I think they plan on like pushing it out even further. Like,
oh, really?
To go into, what's the highest version, like 14.4?
Maybe
I think there might even be like one beyond that, but they're gonna push HSPA. Is that what it is?
HSPA plus
yeah. as far out as they can, and they're actually gonna brand it as a 4G technology,
as AT&T did too, which
yeah.
kills me. But
yeah,
so maybe that's the reason T-Mobile doesn't have a true 4G network, unlike every other carrier will very soon. So maybe they're just getting worried. But still, boo on you, T-Mobile. Hate you. Next article, Tim, I believe you submitted.
Yeah, and it's along the same vein. I mean, Sprint offering now, you know, you have all these phones. They want to charge you an extra $10 a month for premium phones, which, you know, that doesn't make sense.
This is... Oh. I always thought Sprint was good because they always came up as the cheaper plan, like the
yeah.
$99.99 everything plan.
Right, and that makes sense, you know. But now you're going to add $10 a month. Before, it was just $10 a month added to the 4G phones because they were premium phones.
Right.
Again, still don't understand that because, You know, it is what it is. It's data. But, you know, you offer it for 3G now. I mean, why the upcharge? It doesn't make sense after all this time.
Yeah, and this just made me think of something else, that with the iPhone coming out on Verizon now, they still haven't released the data plan prices for the iPhone on Verizon. Most people think the reason they're doing that is because they're going to be more expensive than Verizon's data plans now, and they didn't want to say that at the launch because that would be a downer. Maybe they're going to do the same thing Sprint just did.
You know, I know right now Verizon has a couple different types of data packages. They have data for feature phones. Like if you want data for like
right,
VCast
like
and stuff.
250 meg plan or something.
Well, no, I don't even know if there's really a limit. It's meant you can't get it with a smartphone. You can only get it with feature
My
phones.
My dad has that plan. Yeah.
And then when you get a smartphone, they have a 250 meg plan, and then they have like the 2 or 5 gig plan or whatever it
right.
is. So it's similar in the sense, you know, maybe Sprint just didn't have that demarcation before. But in Verizon's case, the big data plan, the price didn't go up. It's just that they offered a cheaper one for the feature phones.
Well, what I'm worried about now is that it will go up once they introduce these new iPhone data prices,
right?
That they're going to just up the data prices for everything. Because that would be stupid of them to make the iPhone pay more whenever they
right.
have other phones that are quote unquote better, you know, 4G
but
phones.
Why would they make the iPhones pay more? Because points. Number one, Android, they've done studies, Android users use more data than the iPhone. So there's no reason to charge the iPhone users more.
And that's exactly my point though. If they're not going to charge them more, they're just going to charge everybody more.
Right, but they're already the highest in the industry for their data plans. I think that if Verizon raised their data prices like too much, they're going to price themselves out of business. Their network's really good, but I mean, it's not right now. I mean, Sprint is still the cheapest. I mean, unlimited internet's like and everything. Unlimited messaging, internet, and voice is like $99. And no one can touch that right now. I mean, I know their network's limited, but if you live in a place with coverage, it really doesn't matter.
Right. That's the key, though. You have to live in a place with coverage.
Right. Well, I mean, all the major cities have it. So
yeah, not us.
I'd like to, I don't know how many or how much of the, you know, it's hard to compare coverage by people because it depends on how many people are subscribed to the network. But, you know, if you compared it to like AT&T's 3G coverage, like how they've covered like 75% of the population with 3G and 96 with Edge.
Right.
So it's like, I don't know, maybe Sprint's 3G service is close to AT&T's. I don't know in terms of coverage. But anyway, yeah. The point is like, If you have coverage under Sprint, everyone says Sprint's network's better. It's in terms of data speeds. So why would Verizon wouldn't stand a chance in the cities? You know.
Yeah, it's I just keep getting worried because, you know, it seems like every week we see an article somebody's charging more.
Yeah, nickel and diming you, really.
That's exactly it.
Yeah. Oh, it's crap. I agree, but I don't see Verizon's prices going up.
It's interesting you say that. I'm the exact opposite. I see them going up, not just for the iPhone, but for everybody. But I guess we have to wait until, what is it, February 10th, when the iPhone actually hits the stores, till we see that.
Well, you know, they just did away with new every two.
That's ridiculous.
Yeah, they got rid of new every two, and now it's a 20-month. You have to keep your phone for 20 months if you're under a two-year contract before you can upgrade. And before, I don't know exactly how it worked, but I would always get an email or an offer saying, like, about a year in, hey, why don't you come upgrade your phone?
Right. Now, no more early upgrades.
Yeah, now apparently that's gone away, too.
Yeah. Well, that was about was getting you to sign up for another 2 years. Because if you take the deal, you have to sign another two-year contract.
Right. Which, I mean, most people don't have a problem with if they get a new phone.
Right.
You know, I'm not going to sign a contract if I don't get a new phone, but with the case of the iPhone, I bought a new one every year, and I don't mind signing a new contract because I get a new phone out of it.
Right. I mean, I think that was very special for iPhone customers for the most part, that they got one every year.
Yeah. Well, it was very special that they didn't charge us an early upgrade fee.
Yeah.
Yeah. Either way, our next story is something I alluded to earlier with Tim and his Motorola phones. So we had an article a while ago about Motorola and their eFuse technology. Basically, literally a fuse written in code that would break if you tried to modify the firmware on the phone, rendering your phone a brick. And I don't, we still didn't know if you could load up the original firmware yourself or if you had to take it to a store to have them load it up. But either way, if you tried to jailbreak your phone or modify the OS, it bricked itself. And they said, you know, oh, we're not doing that anymore. Article just came out on Wednesday. Yep, they're going to do it. So Motorola is back on the bandwagon of this eFuse technology. And Tim, I wanted your thoughts since you have two Motorola phones.
Yeah, you know, it took a while. I think they were saying one of them already had it. I don't know which one.
I think it's the Droid Bionic and the Atrix 4G. Oh, no, wait. The Atrix 4G doesn't carry it, so maybe the Droid Bionic does. But there is a phone that does.
Yeah. And you know, I just wonder how long it's going to take the people who are developing, you know, these ROMs for these phones to actually get past this eFuse technology or whatever it's called.
Yeah, I wonder how it's implemented, if you can get past it or if it's something in hardware
There's actually an article that came out today on Engadget that kind of a little bit reverses this. I don't think Motorola is going to relent on the eFuse technology, but they did issue a statement that says they apologize for the feedback we provided regarding our bootloader policy. They are going to supposedly provide a bootloader for developers so that if you do want to load a different ROM, you can.
Okay, that's interesting. Okay.
But it's not going to be like something you can do yourself. You're going to have to go use their tools to do it.
So you have to sign up for like a developer account or whatever, and
maybe. And I don't know if it's going to cost anything, but they say they're going to provide people with the ability. So, you know, remains to be seen. I think they don't stand behind the last statement that person made about it.
Yeah, because that was a bad thing that on Twitter, a Motorola employee replied to somebody and said, "If you want to do custom ROMs, then buy elsewhere. We'll continue with our strategy that is working. Thanks."
Yeah.
Like, really, Motorola, you said that? And that's the reason I brought this up for you, Tim, because I know you have a custom ROM.
Yeah.
You know, what would this make you want to buy another Motorola phone if you couldn't do that and get rid of the bloatware?
You know, it's one of those things. I think that, you know, if the developers have this enough, they're going to get past it.
It's going to get out that,
you know,
people can do it.
And it took a little while. I think the Droid 2 came out and it had some sort of protection on it. And it took them a little while to get by it. They eventually did. Same thing with the Droid X.
Right.
You know, in the beginning, they were saying, hey, hold up. Don't do anything to your Droid X. Just wait until we get this all situated and figured out. But now you can do custom ROMs for that. My theory is if you own the phone, do what you want to it.
Goes back to the Sony thing.
It does. It really does.
It's your phone.
Yeah.
So keeping on with Android, our next article from Bloomberg. Google Android more vulnerable than the iPhone, antivirus maker says. So,
doesn't surprise me.
Trend Micro, a representative from Trend Micro, said that Android is open source, which means the hacker can also understand the underlying architecture and the source code. And even though we really haven't seen viruses out for Android, this is something I've been saying for the longest time. You know, Android is open. There's no restrictions on who puts an app in the marketplace. You know, so it is more susceptible to viruses. Do you ever consider that when you're downloading from the marketplace, Tim?
I look at what I download. I mean, you look at the ratings. If the ratings are pretty good, you know,
so buyer beware, really.
Yeah, really it is. I mean, if the app looks sketchy, don't download it. And that's pretty much the motto I live by. But,
right.
You know, you're right. Anyone can make an app. Anyone could put an app in the market. I've made two apps.
Nice.
You know, so I mean, it's using the app inventor tool that they have, but you know, anyone can make an app at this point. So who knows what they can do? And I'm sure that the iPhone, because it's more locked down, will be safer.
Now, what do you think, Ryan, in terms of your BlackBerry, or unless you want to comment on that, since BlackBerry, you can install other apps too. You're not limited in any way. Do you think that follows in the same line as Android being a lot more vulnerable?
I don't know. I mean, I definitely think that if anything, Android's probably more vulnerable for the simple fact that the source code's available. I think to find a bug in Android would probably be easier than other OSs in terms of finding it. I'm not saying there'd be more of them.
Right, because BlackBerry doesn't release their source code.
Right. I don't think they do. Having the ability to put apps on, I mean, Android does have the ability to put apps on not from the market, right?
Yeah. You can use there's a checkbox in the application development menu. You just go on, it says run, I think it's untrusted apps or something like that.
Right.
And it's simple enough. Pretty much anybody can do it. And I think it's available on most phones, except I think there was a phone or two on the AT&T, I think, had a couple that you couldn't go on.
You couldn't do that.
So can you download from the internet? Like if somebody posts a link to an app on the internet, yeah, you click on it and it installs.
Yeah, I actually had somebody email me an app the other day.
There's a website called MobiHand that I've actually bought some BlackBerry apps from. They're the primary retailer for Berryweather, which is probably the most famous or the best weather app for BlackBerry. That's pretty much the only place you can get it. And I thought I saw Android apps on there as well.
Interesting.
So they might even be able to get. Like it might even be able to be trusted in the sense that you wouldn't have to undo that change or undo that or unset that setting or whatever it is, but I think they probably have to somehow get the certification that it's a trusted app somehow.
Right, right. Are you guys worried about browsing the internet in a sense that apps aren't like your web browser isn't really sandboxed, and that if you browse the internet, somebody puts up an exploit for your phone? You get hit with that. Is that a worry for either of you?
No.
Nothing?
Not really. I mean, again, it's watch where you go. And that's what I try to live by. And I don't go anywhere that I think is going to be, a dicey place.
Right. That's buyer beware. I mean, that's perfect. Just don't do stupid things.
The problem is with some of the recent bugs, at least in Windows, in IE susceptible ones, is that the bugs were in the ads. And you can't control what ad you're going to see.
Right, that could be on New York Times site.
Right. So, I mean, there's always ways for them to get into the system somehow. But
so that brings up another point. Would either of you consider running an antivirus on your phones? Knowing how sluggish machines become when you install antivirus on a regular machine, would you do that on your phone?
I don't think we're there yet. I mean, there's not enough I just don't think there's enough risk. It's a risk-reward thing. Until Microsoft came out with Security Essentials, I never even ran antivirus on my laptop because I wasn't going to run a third-party solution that, I don't know any virus solutions that are both fast and lightweight, like in terms of their footprint. They're either super slow or like semantic stuff. They installs like 15 different memory resident programs.
Yeah, if you don't have a corporate version of Symantec, their personal things are crap.
Even the corporate ones now, the endpoint puts in, I'd say, at least 4 memory resident programs.
Oof.
They're hefty too, and they decide to kick off a search and start using resources, and it's like, what are you doing? Like, I know they're doing real-time searching, but it's like it shouldn't affect the performance of the machine.
Right. And nobody wants that on their phone.
No.
Yeah.
All right, so moving on, I believe our next article is from you, Ryan.
Lost my place here. Oh, yeah, Verizon deal. There's some interesting insight into the history between the Verizon and AT&T deal. Well, not the deal, the relationship between the two, and that a lot of the heat that AT&T took initially was, with regard to the network, was from flaws in the iPhone. At least in this New York Times article claims, and that now that the phone may be coming or is coming to Verizon, that if there are problems on both networks with specific things, now there's going to be a common denominator that everybody can point to that might be the iPhone. So the worry is that this may expose some flaws in the iPhone itself.
Yeah, I definitely think that's a problem. I think that it's not really apples to apples in the sense that they changed the antenna, because the silver band being the antenna for the AT&T version was not, you couldn't do that with the way a CDMA antenna needs to work, so they changed it. So if they do have like reception problems on Verizon, it's not going to be exactly the same. I mean, I don't know how much they had to change the antenna, whether they had to change code also or other hardware, or if it was just the antenna. But yeah, that's what a lot of people were worried about, that if something goes wrong, it's now Apple's fault. And Apple's never at fault.
Right. And the example they give mainly is drop calls.
Right.
That there's now maybe some proof out there that there were serious flaws in the network stack inside the iPhone that caused some of these problems.
Right. Have you ever had a drop call on your BlackBerry?
I have, but I think most of the time I've had drop calls, I'm in a car doing 60, 65 miles an hour.
Right. And cell phone handoffs or something.
Yeah, I mean, tower handoffs are not still not perfect.
Right. Tim, have you had
same deal? Pretty much same deal. I mean, you know, that's pretty much the only time I run into a drop call, and it's very rare.
Yeah, I mean, I have never run into a drop call not moving. Whenever I drive down 56 going from Johnstown to Seward, there's that one part where the tower handoff just disappears and you lose signal and you're done. But other than that, like I guess we could say none of us have had real dropped calls, like just being in our house and it goes dead.
Just random.
Yeah.
I mean, I think, I'm not saying it's never happened. It's probably happened. Like, but happened a lot? No. Like maybe I'd say once every couple months tops. You know, and given how much I use my phone, I find it acceptable.
Right.
You know, and a lot of times I don't even know if it's the phone. It's like I could have bumped the end button with my cheek, you know, or the other person could have done the same thing, or they could have been driving.
Right. Very true.
So it's really hard to know.
Yeah. I always wonder how bad this dropped call issue is because I never had a problem. People I know don't have problems. Maybe it's just because we don't live in San Francisco.
Yeah. The article says that it says that I guess the Apple sources that they talked to said that there were, you know, the software running on the iPhone's main radio, they call it baseband, was full of bugs and it did contribute to drop calls. So, you know, they may have fixed it, but I guess the point is if there is a new bug, they're not going to be able to blame the network.
Right. Okay, so show of hands, who's interested in an iPad 2? Does anybody care? Okay, so two out of us three. Reason I bring it up is because a German site is now apparently publishing some inside info that the iPad 2 is going to release the first or second week of April in the US. And I think that is amazing. But this also leads into, you know, the next article that Ryan, you submitted with a, you know, the future of the iPad 2, the iPhone 5. So why don't we just talk about all of that? You can go right into
Sure. There's some interesting things that Apple is, you know, there are some designs decisions they've made. And one of the decisions is that the radio chips in the iPhone and the iPad were originally provided by Infineon. And now they've switched to Qualcomm chipsets. This is a big deal. Qualcomm is basically the biggest and really only provider of CDMA chipsets. So it's really no surprise that they would go to Qualcomm. But Qualcomm also makes GSM chipsets, I believe, or at least integrates them into their solutions somehow. And now the iPhone is going to use a whole new chipset, and that this will probably be the case for the iPad 2 and the iPhone 5, because typically they go with one vendor for everything.
Right.
So it's a pretty big deal. It's one of the first big, you know, major changes in their hardware.
Yeah, so I'm very interested in the iPad too. Tim, you weren't interested. Are you not interested in tablets or just the iPad?
It's the Apple thing. You know, I'm not a big Apple guy. Give me what's coming out, Motorola Zoom or something.
That looks really cool.
Yeah, something like that. I'm an Android guy.
Okay.
You know, give me an Android system and I'm happy. I'm just not a huge Apple guy.
Nice. We can't be friends anymore.
Okay. Well, we'll see ya.
I'm mainly interested in the iPad 2 for the the video conferencing type thing. I think it may be
front facing camera.
Yeah, I think that's gonna be pretty cool. And I'm interested to see what else they add. If the one nice thing is the SD reader. I have a camera that I take with me. It's got an SD slot. And it'd be nice to be able to, use that, pull that SD when I'm on travel or something, just take the iPad and download my photos to it or something. I think that's kind of a neat thing to do with it. So I don't know. I'll definitely consider it. I'm not saying I'm going to run out and buy one.
I'm going to run out and buy one. I've been wanting a tablet.
Yeah, but I thought you said you wanted to hold out for something that was more in the artsy, like design type thing where you could do more design on the tablet.
Okay, so when I said that, I meant like whenever I thought that a MacBook was going to have like a convertible screen or they would release a tablet that was a MacBook.
Right.
Like, I don't want, because tablets are too underpowered to do things like Photoshop and Illustrator. I really wanted, before I bought this MacBook, for them to release a touch or pen device with the MacBook innards, you know, a real processor and real memory. But now I'm just looking for a tablet for my photography portfolio.
Right.
That's really all I want it for. And as I mentioned last week, I was looking at the BlackBerry Playbook, but now that you have to buy a Sprint contract with it, I'm not anymore.
Oh, yeah.
So iPad 2 comes out. That thing is mine.
You know, I don't know. What do you think about an iPad 2 that's not really an iPad 2? Maybe it's another tablet device that runs macOS.
I don't understand.
Well, the reason I say this is, like, there hasn't... I mean, I don't think there's been any, like, confirmation that this iPad 2 is going to be an iPad 2.
No, there's no real confirmation.
It's a second tablet, and... it's
oh, I see what you mean.
And it's going to have a huge... This resolution is supposed to be out of this world, like, huge, like 2,000 pixels by something or other, you know, or close to 1,900.
It's supposed to be like 2K.
Yeah. So, you know, it may have the resolution to support, like, a full-blown operating system.
That could be.
You know, and it would be really neat if it did, you know.
Yeah, but I'm not saying I want an iPad just because it's an iPad. If they release this next tablet that is amazing, I'll buy it too.
Right.
Like, I just want something. I'm waiting for the new thing to come out to see what it is.
Right.
I don't want to buy an iPad now and then 2 weeks from now, something new comes out.
What do you think? Do you think it'll have LTE?
Funny. That's not even a question anymore. We know nobody's going to have LTE for another 6 months. That's just ridiculous.
I don't know. They're saying Verizon phones this quarter.
Verizon phones, maybe, yeah.
Yeah.
But nobody
else. Well,
what
if the iPad 2 comes out on Verizon? Do you think the iPad 2 will release on Verizon? Do you think it'll even be CNN?
I do.
I think it will,
yeah.
I mean, with the Qualcomm chipset, I don't see how it couldn't.
Right. Yeah, especially since the iPhone now went to Verizon, I think anything Apple releases mobile-wise is going to be AT&T and Verizon.
Yeah, I agree with that.
Yeah, it would be stupid not to. And our last article of the show, Ryan, I believe you also submitted this one.
Yeah, this is the last article is basically about why Apple won't ditch the home button on the iPhone and the iPad. And they have some interesting information on the why.
So wait, they were thinking of ditching the home button?
Well, I guess there's been samples of it with no home button, engineering samples or something. But I think for me, the biggest reason is I think you just want to have a hardware button to be able to, like, reboot the thing, you know? Like, I don't know about on the iPhone, but on the iPod, you have to, like, hold down the button to reboot it.
On the iPhone and iPad, there's a small button on the top that is used for powering, and the home button itself is only used for, like, going home, you know, doing things within applications. It's not really a hardware button, per se. But yeah, the video that came from this Ars Technica article was really cool, that the new iOS 4.3 showed gestures with more than two fingers. Because right now, you know, we're just limited to two fingers on the iPhone, and they're showing four and five to mimic what a home button can do.
Right.
Basically the same gestures I have on my MacBook, and most people with laptops with multi-touch can do too. So I think that's really cool that they're implementing that on mobile devices. Although, Tim, would you ever buy a phone without a button to get to a home screen?
See, that's the thing. I mean, I'm okay with all the touchscreen. I like the touchscreen stuff. But I like to have physical buttons. I mean, even if they're not physical buttons, like the Droid X that I have has actual buttons that you can press down on and you feel them press. But the original Droid just has four... They're four
dedicated
keys.
Touch places.
Right. And, you know, but I still consider them buttons.
Right.
You know, I know that if I want to go back a screen, I just hit that little arrow that looks like it's going backwards. If I want to go home, I hit the home button. I like to have a button. I like to have something that I can touch where I know that it's going to take me to a certain location.
Right.
Yeah, I think that was actually something that, everyone really knocks Windows Mobile, but one of its better features was that they had a spec for all the phones that they had to have a Windows button and a OK button. And I think like volume buttons. I think those were the key buttons they had to have. And it was nice because you could operate a lot of apps with just the Windows button and the OK button, you know, and a directional pad. You know, you could really like do a lot with like one hand, you know.
And that's the thing that a lot of people are saying. If Apple goes to a no button device, how are you going to operate this one handed?
Right.
You can't anymore.
In some ways, it's a good thing. It may prevent people from like texting and driving.
That's true.
But on the other hand, I think it makes the usability less for people with disabilities, which I think the article, you know, they mentioned that.
Right.
Mm-hmm. So there's reasons to stick with a hardware button. I could see them going to a touch button. It's a dedicated button, but it's touch. That might, you know, help.
Yeah. I think the reason they wanted to do this too is to squeeze more screen out of it. Some of the things that people thought were early prototypes, the screen was like the whole device.
Mm-hmm.
And now if you look at the iPad, it has that 1-inch bezel the whole way around. So some of the quote unquote prototypes got rid of that 1-inch bezel.
Yeah. See, now on the iPad, the iPad's an inherently two-hand device. I mean,
right.
But the iPhone, I think, is usable with one hand.
Yeah. I use my iPhone 90% of the time with one hand.
Yeah.
And I think most people do that with their phones.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So I'm interested in the gestures. I will use them if they put it out, but I hope they don't get rid of the home button. I think everybody needs a home button.
I agree.
So that is it for this episode of the Slongcast. A lot shorter than I thought it was going to be. We were all worried that with the amount of articles we had, it was going to be a 3-hour show, but definitely not a 3-hour show. So as usual, you can find me around the interwebs on Facebook and Twitter. My username is Slongcack. Ryan, where can people find you?
Oh, I'm on the other internet, as according to Senator Franken, that we've now created two internets because of this net neutrality deal.
Oh,
so
that's
I'm on the other internet.
That's not good.
Hmm. Yeah. So you can reach me there.
Oh, okay. And Tim, if people want to find out what you do, how do they follow you?
A couple ways. WJACTV.com. Obviously, I do the weather, so you can click under there. We're on Facebook, we're on Twitter, and you can find me. My personal account for Twitter is TT_7.
You're a weatherman?
Yeah.
Oh, wow. I didn't know that.
Really?
No, I'm just kidding.
Yeah, I was going to say.
I was worried there for a second.
We've just done this, 2-hour broadcast?
And right. Actually, yeah, exactly 2 hours. But if you want to submit articles for next week's show will be episode 21, so tag it on Delicious, Slongcast021, and we will definitely make a point to talk about it. And other than that, have fun shoveling your driveways, everybody.